Chapter 27.
Let me say in conclusion that had it not been for the increase in revenue generated last month by the Barrington plant and its products, the Unaware division's losses would have continued for the seventh consecutive month. All of the other manufacturing operations in the division reported only marginal gains in performance or sustained losses. Despite the improvement at Barrington and the fact that as a result the division recorded its first operating profit of this year, we have a long way to go before we are back on solid financial footing.
Having said that, Ethan Frost gets the nod from Bill Peach and sits down. I'm sitting halfway down a long table where all the plant managers are gathered. On Peach's right is Hilton Smythe, who happens to be glowering at me in the aftermath of Frost's tribute to my plant. I relax in my chair and for a moment allow myself to contemplate the view through the broad plate glass window, a sunny city on an early summer day. May has ended. Aside from the problem with the shortages of non-bottleneck parts, which have now gone away, it's been an excellent month. We're now timing the release of all materials according to a new system Ralph Nakamura developed, which is keyed to the speed of the bottlenecks. He's got a data terminal now at both of the bottlenecks, so as inventory is processed, the latest information can be fed directly into the plant database. With the new system, we're beginning to see excellent results. Ralph did a little experimenting with the system and soon discovered we can predict within a day, more or less, when a shipment will leave the plant. Based on this, we've been able to put together a report to marketing listing all customer orders and dates when they will be shipped. I don't know if anybody in marketing really believes that report, but so far, it's been highly accurate.
Rogo, because you seem to be the only one among us who has improved to any degree, we'll let you start the round of reports.
I open up the cover of my report and launch into a presentation of the highlights. By almost every standard, we've had a good month. Inventory levels have fallen and are continuing to fall rapidly. Withholding some materials has meant we're no longer choking on work in process. Parts are reaching the bottlenecks when they're supposed to, and the flow through the plant is much smoother than before. And what happened to efficiencies? Well, they did fall initially, as we began to withhold raw material from the floor, but not as much as we'd been afraid they would. It turns out we were consuming excess inventory. But with the rate of shipments up dramatically, that excess has melted quickly, and now that we're beginning to resume releases of materials to non-bottlenecks again, efficiencies are on their way back up. Donovan has even told me confidentially he thinks the real numbers in the future will be almost the same as before. The best news is we've wiped out our backlog of overdue orders. Amazing as it seems, we're completely caught up. So customer service has improved. Throughput is up. We're on our way back. It's too bad the standard report we've prepared can't begin to tell the full story of what's really going on. When I've finished, I look up the table and see Hilton Smythe whispering something to Bill Peach. There's quiet around the table for a moment. Then Bill nods to Hilton and talks to me.
Good job, Al.
Through with me, Bill asks another manager to deliver his report. I sit back, irritated slightly that Peach wasn't more positive, that he didn't put more praise on me the way Frost had indicated he should. I came in here feeling as though we'd really turned the plant around, and I guess I expected a little more than a good job pat on the head. But then I have to remind myself that Peach doesn't know the extent of the change. Should he know? Should we be telling him? Lou has asked me about this, and I've told him, no, let's hold off for a while. We could go to Bill Peach and make a presentation to him, put all our cards on the table, and let him decide. In fact, that's exactly what we will do eventually, but not yet. And I think I have a good reason. I've worked with Bill Peach for a lot of years. I know him pretty well. He's a smart man, but he's not an innovator. A couple of years ago, he might have let us run with this for a while. Not today. I have a feeling if we go to him now, he'll put on his hard nose and tell me to run the plant by the cost accounting methods he believes in. I have to bide my time until I can go to him with a solid case that my way, Jonah's way, really, is the one that truly works. It's too early for that. We've broken too many rules to tell him the full story now. But will we have the time? That's what I keep asking myself. Peach hasn't voluntarily lifted the threat to close the plant. I thought he might say something, publicly or privately, after this report. But he hasn't. I look at him at the end of the table. He seems distracted, not like himself. The others talk, and he seems only half interested. Hilton seems to cue him on what to say. What's with him? The meeting breaks up about an hour after lunch, and by then, I've decided to have a private talk with Peach, if I can get it. I follow him out into the corridor from the conference room and ask him. He invites me into his office. So, when are you going to let us off the hook? Bill sits down in a big, upholstered chair, and I take the one opposite him. Without the desk between us, it's a nice little intimate chat.
What makes you think I'm going to?
Barrington's on its way back. We can make that plant make money for the division.
Can you? Look, Al, you've had a good month. That's a step in the right direction, but can you give us a second good month and a third and a fourth? That's what I'm waiting for.
We'll give them to you.
I'm going to be frank. I'm not yet convinced that this hasn't been just a flash in the pan, so to speak. You had a huge overdue backlog. It was inevitable you'd ship it eventually. What have you done to reduce cost? Nothing that I can see. It's going to take a 10 or 15% reduction in operating expense to make the plant profitable for the long term.
I feel my heart sink. Bill, if next month we turn in another improvement, will you at least delay the recommendation to close the plant?
It'll have to be a bigger improvement than what you gave us in this past period.
How big?
Just give me 15% more on the bottom line than you did this month.
I think we can do that. I note the split second of shock blink into Peach's face.
Fine. If you can deliver that and keep delivering it, we'll keep Barrington open.
If I do this for you, I'm thinking, you'd be an idiot to close us. Peach stands, our chat concluded. I fly the Buick up the entrance ramp to the interstate with the accelerator floored and the radio turned up loud. The adrenaline is pumping. The thoughts in my head are racing faster than the car. 2 months ago, I figured I might be sending out my resume by now. But Peach just said if we turned in another good month, he'd let the plant stay open. We're almost there. We just might be able to pull this off. Just one more month. But 15%? We've been eating up our backlog of orders at a terrific rate. And by doing so, we've been able to ship a tremendous volume of product. Tremendous by any comparison. Last month, last quarter, last year. It's given us a big surge of income, and it's looked fantastic on the books. But now that we've shipped all the overdues, and we're putting out new orders much faster than before, the thought creeps up on me that I'm in really big trouble. Where the hell am I going to get the orders that will give me an extra 15%? Peach isn't just asking for another good month. He's demanding an incredible month. He hasn't promised anything. I have, and probably too much. I'm trying to remember the orders scheduled for the coming weeks and attempting to calculate in my head if we're going to have the volume of business necessary for the bottom line increase Peach wants to see. I have a scary feeling it won't be enough. Okay, I can ship ahead of schedule. I can take the orders scheduled for the first week or two of July and ship them in June instead. But what am I going to do after that? I'm going to be putting us into a huge hole in which we have nothing else to do. We need more business. I wonder where Jonah is these days. Glancing down at the speedometer, I find to my surprise that I'm zipping along at 80. I slow down. I loosen my tie. No sense killing myself trying to get back to the plant. It occurs to me, in fact, that by the time I get back to the plant, it'll be time to go home. Just about then, I pass a sign saying I'm 2 miles from the interchange that would put me on the highway to Forest Grove. Well, why not? I haven't seen Julie or the kids in a couple of days. Since the end of school, the kids have been staying with Julie and her parents. I take the interchange and get off at the next exit. At a gas station on the corner, I find a payphone and make a call to the office. Fran answers, and I tell her two things. First, pass the word to Bob, Stacy, Ralph, and Lou that the meeting went well for us. And second, I tell her not to expect me to come in this afternoon. When I get to the Barnett's house, I get a nice welcome. I spend quite a while just talking to Sharon and Dave. Then Julie suggests we go for a walk together. It's a fine summer afternoon outside. As I'm hugging Sharon to say goodbye, she whispers in my ear,
Daddy, when are we all going to go home together?
Real soon, I hope. Despite the assurance I gave her, Sharon's question doesn't go away. I've been wondering the same thing myself. Julie and I go to the park, and after walking for a while, we sit down on a bench by the river. We sit without saying anything for a while. She asks me if something is wrong. I tell her about Sharon's question.
She asks me that all the time.
She does?
What do you tell her?
I tell her we'll be going home real soon.
That's what I said to her. Do you really mean that?
You've been a lot of fun to be around in the last few weeks.
Thanks. The feeling is mutual.
But I'm sorry, Al. I'm still worried about coming home.
Why? We're getting along a lot better now. What's the problem?
Look, we've had some good times for a change, and that's fine. I've really needed this time with you. But if we go back to living together, you know what's going to happen, don't you? Everything will be fine for about 2 days. But a week from now, we'll be having the same arguments. And a month later, or 6 months, or a year from now, well, you know what I mean.
Julie, was it that bad living with me?
Al, it wasn't bad. It was just, I don't know. You weren't paying any attention to me.
But I was having all kinds of problems in my job. I was really in over my head for a while. What did you expect from me?
More than what I was getting. You know, when I was growing up, my father always came home from work at the same time. The whole family always ate together. He spent the evenings at home. With you, I never know what's going on.
You can't compare me to your father. He's a dentist. After the last tooth of the day is filled, he can lock up and go home. My business isn't like that.
Alex, the problem is you are not like that. Other people go to work and come home at regular times.
Yes, you're partially right. I am not like other people. When I get involved in something, I really get involved. And maybe that has to do with the way I was brought up. Look at my family. We hardly ever ate together. Somebody always had to be minding the store. It was my father's rule. The business was what fed us, so it came first. We all understood that, and we all worked together.
So what does that prove, except our families were different? I'm telling you about something that bothered me so much and for so long that I wasn't even sure if I loved you anymore.
So what makes you sure you love me now?
Do you want another fight?
No, I don't want a fight.
You see, nothing has changed, has it?
Neither of us says a word for quite a while. Julie gets up and walks over to the river. It looks for a second as if she might run away. She doesn't. She comes back again and sits down on the bench.
When I was 18, I had everything planned. College, a teaching degree, marriage, a house, children. In that order, all the decisions were made. I knew what china pattern I wanted. I knew the names I wanted for the kids. I knew what the house should look like and what color the rug should be. Everything was certain. And it was so important that I have it all. But now, I have it all, only it's different somehow. None of it seems to matter.
Julie, why does your life have to conform to this perfect image you have in your head? Do you even know why you want the things you do?
Because that's how I grew up. And what about you? Why do you have to have this big career? Why do you feel compelled to work 24 hours a day? I'm sorry. I'm just very confused.
No, that's okay. It was a good question. I have no idea why I wouldn't be satisfied being a grocer or a 9-to-5 office worker.
Al, why don't we just try to forget all this?
No, I don't think so. I think we should do the opposite. We ought to start asking a few more questions.
Like what?
Like, what is our marriage supposed to do for us? My idea of the goal of a marriage is not living in a perfect house where everything happens according to a clock. Is that the goal for you?
All I'm asking for is a little dependability from my husband. And what's all this about a goal? When you're married, you're just married. There is no goal.
Then why be married?
You get married because of commitment, because of love, because of all the reasons everybody else does. Alex, you're asking a lot of dumb questions.
Whether they're dumb or smart, I'm asking them because we've been living together for 15 years, and we have no clear understanding of what our marriage is supposed to do, or become, or anything. We're just coasting along, doing what everyone else does. And it turns out the two of us have some very different assumptions of what our lives are supposed to be like.
My parents have been married for 37 years, and they never asked any questions. Nobody ever asks what is the goal of a marriage. People just get married because they're in love.
Oh, well, that explains everything, doesn't it?
Al, please don't ask these questions. They don't have any answers. And if we keep talking this way, we're going to ruin everything. If this is your way of saying you're having second thoughts about us...
Julie, I'm not having second thoughts about you. But you're the one who can't figure out what's wrong with us. Maybe if you tried to think about this logically instead of simply comparing us to the characters in a romance novel...
I do not read romance novels.
Then where did you get your ideas about how a marriage is supposed to be? Look, all I'm saying is we ought to throw away, for the moment, all the preconceptions we have about our marriage and just take a look at how we are right now. Then we ought to figure out what we want to have happen and go in that direction. But Julie doesn't seem to be listening. She stands up.
I think it's time we walked back.
On the way back to the Barnett house, we're as silent as two icebergs in January, the two of us drifting together. I look at one side of the street. Julie looks at the opposite. When we walk through the door, Mrs. Barnett invites me to stay for dinner, but I say I've got to be going. I say goodbye to the kids, give Julie a wave, and leave. I'm getting into the Buick when I hear her come running after me.
Will I see you again on Saturday?
Yeah, sure. Sounds good.
I'm sorry about what happened.
I guess we'll just have to keep trying until we get it right. We both start smiling. Then we do some of that nice stuff that makes an argument almost worth the agony.
Chapter 28.
I get home just as the sun is starting to set. The sky is rosy pink. As I'm unlocking the kitchen door, I hear the phone ringing inside. I rush in to grab it.
Good morning.
Morning? I'm watching the sun set. Where are you calling from?
Singapore.
By
the way, for my hotel, I'm watching the sun rise. Alex, I wouldn't have called you at home, but I'm not going to be able to talk to you again for a few weeks.
Why not?
Well, it's a long story, and I can't go into it now. But I'm sure we'll have a chance to discuss it sometime.
I see. That's too bad. It puts me in a kind of a bind, because I was just about to ask for your help again.
Has something gone wrong?
Nah. Everything's generally going very well from an operations standpoint, but I just had a meeting with my division vice president, and I was told that the plant has to show an even bigger improvement.
You're still not making money?
Yes, we're making money again. But we need to accelerate the improvement to save the plant from being shut down.
If I were you, I wouldn't worry too much about being shut down.
Well, from what the head of the division has told me, the possibility of a shutdown is real. And until he says otherwise, I can't afford to take it lightly.
Alex, if you want to improve the plant even more, I'm with you all the way. And since I won't have the opportunity to speak with you for a while, let's talk about it now. Bring me up to date on what's happening.
So I do. Then, wondering if we've reached some theoretical limit by now, I ask him if there's anything else we can try.
Anything else? Believe me, we have only begun. Now, here is what I suggest.
Early the next morning, I'm in my office at the plant considering what Jonah told me. Outside is the dawn of the day he's already seen in Singapore. Stepping out to get a cup of coffee, I find Stacy at the coffee machine.
Hello there. I hear everything went fairly well for us at headquarters yesterday.
Well, not bad. I'm afraid we still have a long way to go before we convince Peach we're good for the long term. But I talked to Jonah last night.
Did you tell him about our progress?
Yeah, and he suggested we try what he called the next logical step.
What's that?
Cut our batch sizes in half on non-bottlenecks.
But why?
Because in the end, we'll make more money.
I don't understand. How is that going to help us?
Hey, Stacy, you're in charge of inventory control. You tell me what would happen if we cut our batch sizes in half. Thinking, she sips her coffee for a moment. Her brow compresses in concentration.
If we cut our batch sizes in half, then I guess that at any one time we'd have half the work in process on the floor. I guess that means we'd only need half the investment in work in process to keep the plant working. If we could work it out with our vendors, we could conceivably cut all our inventories in half. And by cutting our inventories in half, we reduce the amount of cash tied up at any one time, which eases the pressure on cash flow.
I'm nodding each time she says a sentence. That's right. That's one set of benefits.
But to reap those benefits fully, we'd have to have our suppliers increase the frequency of deliveries to us and reduce the quantity of each delivery. That's going to take some negotiating through purchasing, and I'm not sure all the vendors will go for it.
That's something we can work on. Eventually, they'll go for it, because it's to their advantage as well as ours.
But if we go to smaller batch sizes, doesn't that mean we'll have to have more setups on equipment?
Sure. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about
it. Yeah, don't worry about it.
But
Donovan will do just fine, even with more setups. And meanwhile, there's another set of benefits, aside from what you said, that we can have almost immediately.
What's that?
You really want to know?
Sure I do.
Good. You set up a meeting with the other functions, and I'll tell everyone at the same time. For dumping that little chore of the meeting arrangements on her, Stacy pays me back in kind by setting the meeting for noon at the most expensive restaurant in town, with lunch billable to my expense number, of course.
What could I do? It was the only time everybody was available, right, Bob?
Right.
I'm not mad. Given the quality and quantity of work these people have done recently, I can't complain about picking up the tab for lunch. I get right down to telling everybody what Stacy and I had talked about this morning and lead up to the other set of benefits. Part of what Jonah told me last night over the phone had to do with the time a piece of material spends inside a plant. If you consider the total time from the moment the material comes into the plant to the minute it goes out the door as part of a finished product, you can divide that time into four elements. One of them is setup, the time the part spends waiting for a resource, while the resource is preparing itself to work on the part. Another is process time, which is the amount of time the part spends being modified into a new, more valuable form. A third element is queue time, which is the time the part spends in line for a resource while the resource is busy working on something else ahead of it. The fourth element is wait time, which is the time the part waits, not for a resource, but for another part so they can be assembled together. As Jonah pointed out last night, setup and process are a small portion of the total elapsed time for any part. But queue and wait often consume large amounts of time. In fact, the majority of the elapsed total that the part spends inside the plant. For parts that are going through bottlenecks, queue is the dominant portion. The part is stuck in front of the bottleneck for a long time. For parts that are only going through non-bottlenecks, wait is dominant, because they are waiting in front of assembly for parts that are coming from the bottlenecks, which means that in each case, the bottlenecks are what dictate this elapsed time, which in turn means the bottlenecks dictate inventory as well as throughput. We've been setting batch sizes according to an economical batch quantity, or EBQ, formula. Last night, Jonah told me that although he didn't have time over the phone to go into all the reasons, EBQ has a number of flawed assumptions underlying it. Instead, he asked me to consider what would happen if we cut batch sizes by half from their present quantities. If we reduce batch sizes by half, we also reduce by half the time it will take to process a batch. That means we reduce queue and wait by half as well. Reduce those by half, and we reduce by about half the total time parts spend in the plant. Reduce the time parts spend in the plant, and our total lead time condenses. And with less time spent sitting in a pile, the speed of the flow of parts increases.
And with faster turnaround on orders, customers get their orders faster.
Not only that, but with shorter lead times, we can respond faster.
That's right. If we can respond to the market faster, we get an advantage in the marketplace.
That means more customers come to us because we can deliver faster.
Our sales increase.
And so do our bonuses.
Whoa, now hold up here a minute.
What's the matter?
What about setup time? You cut batch sizes in half, you double the number of setups. What about direct labor? We gotta save on setups to keep down costs.
Okay, I knew this would come up. Now look, it's time we think about this carefully. Jonah told me last night that there was a corresponding rule to the one about an hour lost at a bottleneck. You remember that? An hour lost at a bottleneck is an hour lost for the entire system.
Yeah, I remember.
The rule he gave me last night is that an hour saved at a non-bottleneck is a mirage.
A mirage? What do you mean an hour saved at a non-bottleneck is a mirage? An hour saved is an hour saved.
No, it isn't. Since we began withholding materials from the floor until the bottlenecks are ready for them, the non-bottlenecks now have idle time. It's perfectly okay to have more setups on non-bottlenecks, because all we're doing is cutting into time the machines would spend being idle. Saving setups at a non-bottleneck doesn't make the system one bit more productive. The time and money saved is an illusion. Even if we double the number of setups, it won't consume all the idle time.
Okay. I guess I can see what you mean.
Now, Jonas said, first of all, to cut the batch sizes in half. Then he suggested I go immediately to marketing and convince them to conduct a new campaign which will promise customers earlier deliveries.
Can we do it?
Already, our lead times have condensed considerably over what they were before thanks to the priority system and making the bottlenecks more productive.
We've reduced lead time of about 3 to 4 months down to 2 months or even less. If we cut our batch sizes in half, how fast do you think we can respond?
There's an eternity of hemming and hawing while this is debated.
Okay, if we cut batch sizes in half, then that means it ought to take half the time it does now. So, instead of 6 to 8 weeks, it should take about 4 weeks. Maybe even 3 weeks in a lot of cases.
Suppose I go to marketing and tell them to promise customers deliveries in 3 weeks.
Oh, whoa, hold on.
Yeah, give us a break.
All right, 4 weeks then. That's okay. Reasonable, isn't it?
Sounds reasonable to me.
Well, okay.
I think we should risk it.
So, are you willing to commit to this with us?
Well, I'm all for bigger bonuses. What the hell? Let's try it.
Friday morning finds the Buick and me again hustling up the interstate toward headquarters. I hit town just as the sun hits the glass of the Unico building and reflects a blinding glare. Kind of pretty, actually. For a moment, it takes my mind off my nerves. I've got a meeting scheduled with Johnny Johns in his office. When I called, he was quite willing to see me, but sounded less than enthusiastic about what I said I'd like to talk about. I feel there's a lot riding on my ability to convince him to go along with what we want to do, so I found myself biting a fingernail or two during the trip. Johns doesn't really have a desk in his office. He's got a sheet of glass on chrome legs. I guess that's so everyone can get a good look at his Gucci loafers and silk socks, which he exposes as he leans back in his chair, interweaves his fingers, and puts them behind his head.
So, how's everything going?
Everything's going very well right now. In fact, that's why I wanted to talk to you. Johns immediately dons an impassive face. All right, listen, I'm going to lay my cards out for you. I'm not exaggerating when I say everything is going well. It is. We've worked off our backlog of overdue orders, as you know. At the beginning of last week, the plant began producing strictly to meet projected due dates.
Yes, I've noticed my phone hasn't been ringing lately with complaints from customers missing their orders.
My point is that we've really turned the plant around. Here, look at this. From my briefcase, I take the latest computer-generated list of customer orders. Among other things, it shows the due dates promised, along with the dates when Ralph expected shipment, and the dates the products were actually shipped. You see, we can predict to within 24 hours, one way or the other, when an order will leave the plant.
Yes, I've seen something like this floating around. These are the dates?
Of course.
This is impressive.
As you can see by comparing a few recently shipped orders with ones of a month or so before, our production lead times have condensed dramatically. 4 months lead time is no longer a holy number with us. From the day you sign the contract with the customer to the day we ship, the current average is about 2 months. Now tell me, do you think that could help us in the marketplace?
Sure it could.
Then how about 4 weeks?
What? Al, don't be ridiculous. 4 weeks?
We can do it.
Come on. Last winter, when demand for every damn thing we make was way down, we were promising delivery in 4 months, and it was taking 6. Now, you're telling me you can go from contract to finished product in 4 weeks?
I wouldn't be here talking to you if we couldn't.
Come on.
Hoping desperately that we're right. Johnny, the truth is I need more business. With our overdues gone and our current backlog declining, I've got to get more work into my plant. Now, we both know the business is out there. It's just that the competition is getting more of it than we are.
You can really turn around an order of 200 Model 12s or 300 DBD-50s in 4 weeks.
Try me. Get me 5 orders. Hell, get me 10 orders, and I'll prove it to you.
And what happens to our credibility if you can't come through?
Flustered, I look down through the glass table. Johnny, I'll make a bet with you. If I don't deliver in 4 weeks, I'll buy you a brand new pair of Gucci's.
Okay, you're on. I'll pass the word to the salespeople that on all your products, we're offering terms of factory shipment in 6 weeks.
Yeah, we can do it in 4, though.
I know you're confident, but if you ship any new orders in less than 5 weeks, I'll buy you a new pair of shoes.
Chapter 29.
A full moon is shining through the bedroom window and into my eyes. The night is still. I look at the clock beside me, which says it's 4:20 a.m., Next to me in bed, Julie is sleeping. Resting on my elbow, I look down at Julie. With her dark hair spilled out on the white pillow, she looks nice sleeping in the moonlight. I watch her for a while. I wonder what her dreams are like. When I woke up, I was having a nightmare. It was about the plant. I was running up and down the aisles, and Bill Peach was chasing me in his crimson Mercedes. Every time he was about to run me over, I'd duck between a couple of machines or hop on a passing forklift. He was yelling at me from the window about my bottom line not being good enough. Finally, he trapped me in the shipping department. I had my back against stacks of cardboard cartons, and the Mercedes was racing toward me at 100 miles an hour. I tried to shield my eyes from the blinding headlights. Just as Peach was about to get me, I woke up and discovered that the headlights were moonbeams on my face. Now I'm too much awake and too aware of the problem I was trying to forget this past evening with Julie for me to fall back to sleep. Not wanting to awaken Julie with my restlessness, I slip out of bed. The house is all ours tonight. We started out this evening with nothing particular to do, when we remembered we had a whole house in Barrington with nobody in it to bother us. So we bought a bottle of wine, some cheese, and a loaf of bread, came here and got comfortable. From the living room window where I stand in the dark looking out, it seems as though the whole world is asleep except me. I'm angry with myself at not being able to sleep, but I can't let go of what's on my mind. Yesterday we had a staff meeting. There was some good news and some bad news. Actually, there was a lot of good news. High among the headlines were the new contracts marketing has been winning for us. We've picked up about half a dozen new orders since I talked to Johnny. More good news was the fact that efficiencies have gone up, not down, as a result of what we've been doing in the plant. After we began withholding the release of materials and timing the releases according to the completed processing of heat treat and the NCX-10, efficiencies dipped somewhat. But that was because we were consuming excess inventories. When the excess inventories were exhausted, which happened quickly as a result of the increase in throughput, efficiencies came back up again. Then, 2 weeks ago, we implemented the new smaller batch sizes. When we cut batch sizes in half for non-bottlenecks, efficiencies stayed solid, and now it seems as though we're keeping the workforce even more occupied than before. That's because a really terrific thing has happened. Before we reduced batch sizes, it wasn't uncommon for a work center to be forced idle because it didn't have anything to process, even though we were wading through excess inventory. It was usually because the idle work center had to wait for the one preceding it to finish a large batch of some item. Unless told otherwise by an expediter, the materials handlers would wait until an entire batch was completed before moving it. In fact, that's still the case. But now that the batches are smaller, the parts are ready to be moved to the next workstation sooner than they were before. What we had been doing many times was turning a non-bottleneck into a temporary bottleneck. This was forcing other work centers downstream from it to be idle, which reflected poorly on efficiencies. Now, even though we've recognized that non-bottlenecks have to be idle periodically, there is actually less idle time than before. Since we cut batch sizes, work is flowing through the plant more smoothly than ever. And it's weird, but the idle time we do have is less noticeable. It's spread out in shorter segments. Instead of people hanging around with nothing to do for a couple of hours, now they'll have maybe a few 10 to 20 minute waits through the day for the same amount of work. From everybody's standpoint, that's much better. Still more good news is that inventories are at their lowest ever in the plant. It's almost shocking to walk out into the plant now. Those stacks and piles of parts and sub-assemblies have shrunk to half their former size. It's as if a fleet of trucks had come and hauled everything away, which is, in fact, about what happened. We've shipped the excess inventory as finished product. Of course, the notable part of the story is that we haven't filled the plant back up again by dumping new work in process on the floor. The only work in process out there now is for current demand. But then there's the bad news, which is what I'm thinking about when I hear footsteps on the carpet behind me in the dark.
Al?
Yeah.
How come you're out here in the dark?
Can't sleep.
What's wrong?
Nothing.
Then why don't you come back to bed?
I'm just thinking about some things. For a moment, I think she's gone away. Then I feel her beside me.
Is it the plant?
Yeah.
But I thought everything was getting better. What's wrong?
It has to do with our cost measurement.
Why don't you tell me about it?
Sure, you want to hear about it?
Yes, I do.
So I tell her. The cost of parts looks as though it's gone up because of the additional setups necessitated by the smaller batch sizes.
Oh, I guess that's bad, right?
Politically speaking, yes. Financially speaking, it doesn't make a damn bit of difference.
How come?
Well, do you know why it looks like the cost has gone up?
No, not at all.
I get up to switch on a lamp and find a piece of paper and pencil. Okay, I'll give you an example. Suppose we have a batch of 100 parts. The time to set up the machine is 2 hours, or 120 minutes, and the process time per part is 5 minutes. So we've invested per part 5 minutes plus 2 hours of setup divided by 100. It comes to 1.2 minutes of setup per part. According to the accountants, the cost of the part is based upon direct labor of 6.2 minutes. Now, if we cut the batch in half, we still have the same amount of setup time. But it's spread over 50 parts instead of 100. So now we've got 5 minutes of process time plus 2.4 minutes of setup for a grand total of 7.4 minutes of direct labor. And the calculations are all based on the cost of direct labor. Then I explained the way costs are calculated. First, there is the raw material cost. Then there is the cost of direct labor. And finally, there is burden, which essentially works out to be cost of the direct labor multiplied by a factor, in our case of about 3. So on paper, if the direct labor goes up, the burden also goes up.
So with more setups, the cost of making parts goes up.
It looks that way, but in fact it hasn't really done anything to our actual expenses. We haven't added more people to the payroll. We haven't added any additional cost by doing more setups. In fact, the cost of parts has gone down since we began the smaller batch sizes.
Down? How come?
Because we've reduced inventory and increased the amount of money we're bringing in through sales. So the same burden, the same direct labor cost, is now spread over more product. By making and selling more product for the same cost, our operating expense has gone down, not up.
How could the measurement be wrong?
The measurement assumes that all of the workers in the plant are always going to be fully occupied, and therefore, in order to do more setups, you have to hire more people. That isn't true.
What are you going to do?
I look up at the window. The sun is now over the roof of my neighbor's house. I reach over for her hand. What am I going to do? I'm going to take you out to breakfast. When I get to the office, Lou walks in. More bad news for me?
Look, I think I can help you out on this cost of products thing.
Yeah? Like how?
I can change the base we're using for determining the cost of parts. Instead of using the cost factor of the past 12 months, which is what I'm supposed to be doing, we can use the past 2 months. That will help us because for the past 2 months, we've had big increases in throughput.
Yeah. Yeah, that might work. And actually, the past 2 months are a lot more representative of what's really going on here than what happened last year.
Well, yes, that's true, but according to accounting policy, it's not valid.
Okay, but we have a good excuse. The plant is different now. We're really a hell of a lot better than we were.
Al, the problem is Ethan Frost will never buy it.
Then why did you suggest it?
Frost won't buy it if he knows about it.
I see.
I can give you something that will slide through on the first glance, but if Frost and his assistants at division do any checking, they'll see through it in no time.
You're saying we could end up in very hot water.
Yeah, but if you want to take a chance.
It could give us a couple more months to really show what we can do. I get up and walk around for a minute, turning this over in my mind. There's no way I can show Peach an increase in the cost of parts and convince him the plant is better off this month than last. If he sees these numbers and gets the idea our costs are going up, we'll be in hot water anyway.
So you want to try it?
Sure.
All right. Remember, if we get caught...
Don't worry. I'll practice my tap dancing. As Lou is on his way out, Fran buzzes me to say Johnny Johns is on my line. We're practically old pals by now. I've been on the phone with him just about every day, and sometimes 3 or 4 times a day for the past few weeks. Hello there. What can I do for you today?
Remember our dear friend Bucky Burnside?
How could I forget good old Bucky? Is he still complaining about us?
No, not anymore. At the moment, in fact, we don't have a single active contract with Burnside's people. That's the reason I'm calling. For the first time in months, they've expressed interest in buying something from us again.
What are they interested in?
Model 12s. They need 1,000 units.
Terrific.
Well, maybe not. They need the whole order by the end of the month.
That's only 2 weeks away.
Yeah, I know. The sales rep on this already checked the warehouse. Turns out we've only got 50 of the Model 12s in stock.
He's telling me, of course, we'll have to manufacture the other 950 by the end of the month if we want the business. Well, Johnny, look, I know I told you I wanted business, and you've pulled in some nice contracts since I talked to you. But 1,000 Model 12s in 2 weeks, that's asking a lot.
Al, to tell you the truth, I didn't really think we could do anything with this one when I called. But I thought I'd let you know about it, just in case you knew something I didn't. After all, 1,000 units means a little over $1 million in sales to us.
Yes, I realize that. Look, what's going on that they need these things so fast?
He tells me he did some digging and found out that the order had originally gone to our number one competitor, who makes a product similar to the Model 12. The competitor had had the order on its books for about 5 months, but they hadn't filled it yet, and this week it became clear that they would not be able to meet the due date.
Well, my guess is that Burnside turned to us because they've heard about us offering such fast turnaround to everyone else. Frankly, I think they're desperate. And hell, if there's any way we can pull this off, it'd sure be a good way for us to save face with them.
Well, I don't know. I'd like that business back again, too, but...
The real kick in the head is if we only had the foresight to build a finished goods inventory of Model 12s while we had those slow sales months. We really could have made this sale.
I have to smile to myself, because at the beginning of the year, I might have agreed with that.
It's too bad. Aside from the initial business, it would have been a big opportunity for us.
How big?
Strong hints have been dropped that if we come through on this one, we could become their preferred supplier.
All right. You really want this, don't you?
So bad I can taste it. But if it's impossible...
When do you have to let him know?
Probably sometime today or tomorrow at the latest. Why? Do you think we can really do it?
Maybe there's a way. Let me see how we stand, and I'll give you a call back. As soon as I get off the phone with Johns, I round up Bob, Stacy, and Ralph for a meeting in my office. And when we're all together, I tell them what Johns told me. Ordinarily, I would think this is out of the question. But before we say no, let's think about it. Everybody looks at me with a certain knowledge that this is going to be a waste of time. Let's just see what we can do, okay? For the rest of the morning, we're busy with this. We go over the bill of material. Stacy checks on raw materials inventories. Ralph does a quick estimate on how long it will take to produce 1,000 units after the materials are on hand. By 11 o'clock, he has calculated that the bottlenecks can turn out parts for the Model 12 at the rate of about 100 per day.
So yes, it would be technically feasible for us to do the order, but that's only if we work on nothing else for 2 weeks except 1,000 units for Burnside.
Nah, I don't want to do that. Screwing up relations with a dozen customers just to please one. Let's try something else.
Like what?
Bob is sitting there with us, looking about as enthusiastic as a bump on a log. A few weeks ago, we cut our batch sizes by half, and the result was we could condense the time inventory spends in the plant, which also gave us an increase in throughput. What if we cut the batch sizes by half again?
Gee, I hadn't thought of that.
Cut them again? Oh, sorry, Al, but I don't see how the heck that can help us, not with the volume we're already committed to.
You know, we have quite a few orders we'd planned to ship ahead of their due dates. We could reschedule some of those in the priority system so they'd ship when promised instead of early. That could give us more time available on the bottlenecks, and it wouldn't hurt anybody.
Good point, Ralph.
But hell, we still can't get 1,000 units done, no how. Not in 2 weeks.
Well then, if we cut the batch sizes, how many units can we do in 2 weeks and still ship our current orders on time?
Well, I guess I could look into it.
I'll see what I can find out.
Hey, maybe I better go with you so we can noodle this thing out together.
While Ralph and Bob are wrestling with this new possibility, Stacy enters with news about inventories. She's ascertained we can obtain all the materials we need, either from our own stocks or from vendors within a few days, with one exception.
The electronic control modules for the Model 12 are a problem. We don't have enough of this type in stock, and we don't have the technology to build them in-house. But we've located a vendor in California who has them. Unfortunately, the vendor can't promise a shipment of that quantity in less than 4 to 6 weeks, including shipping. I'd say we might as well forget it.
Wait a minute, Stacy. We're thinking about a little change in strategy. How many modules could they give us per week? And how soon could they ship the first week's quantity to us?
I don't know, but doing it that way, we might not be able to get a volume discount.
Why not? We'd be committing to the same 1,000 units. It's just that we'd be staggering the shipments.
Well, then there's the added shipping cost.
Stacy, we're talking $1 million in business here.
Okay, but they'll take at least 3 days to a week to get here by truck.
So why can't we have them shipped air freight? They're not very big parts.
Well, I don't know, but
look into it. But I doubt if the air freight bill is going to eat up the profit on $1 million sale. And if we can't get these parts, we can't get the sale.
All right, I'll see what they can do.
At the end of the day, the details are still being sweated out, but we know enough for me to place a call to Johns. I've got a deal on those Model 12s for you to relay to Burnside.
Really? You want to take on the business?
Under certain conditions. First of all, there's no way we can deliver the full 1,000 units in 2 weeks, but we can ship 250 per week to them for 4 weeks.
Well, okay, they might go for that. But when can you start shipping?
2 weeks from the day they give us the order.
Are you sure about this?
The units will ship when we say they will.
You're You're that confident?
Yep.
Okay, all right. I'll call them and I'll see if they're interested. But, Al, I just hope what you're telling me is real, because I don't want to go through all the hassles we had before with these people.
A couple of hours later, my phone rings at home.
Al, we got it! We got the order!
And in my mind, I hear $1 million ring up on the cash register.
And you know what? They even like the smaller shipments better than getting all 1,000 units at once.
Okay, great. I'll get the ball rolling right away. You can tell them that 2 weeks from today, we'll ship the first 250.
Chapter 30.
At the beginning of the new month, we have a staff meeting. Everyone is present except Lou. Bob tells me he'll be in shortly. I sit down and fidget. To get the meeting rolling while we're waiting for Lou, I ask about shipments. How's Burnside's order coming along?
Well, the first shipment went out as scheduled.
What about the rest of it?
No problems to speak of.
Okay.
The control boxes were a day late, but there was time enough for us to assemble without delaying the shipment. We got this week's batches from the vendor on time.
Good. What's the latest on the smaller batches?
The flow through the shop's even better now.
Excellent. Just then, Lou comes into the meeting. He's late because he was finishing the figures for this month. He sits down and looks straight at me. Well, did we get our 15%?
No. We got 17%, thanks in part to Burnside. And the coming month looks just fine.
Then he goes into a wrap-up of how we performed through the second quarter. We're now solidly in the black. Inventories are about 40% of what they were 3 months ago. Throughput has doubled. Well, we've come a long way, haven't we?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sitting on my desk when I got back from lunch the next day are two crisp, white envelopes with the Uniware division logo in the upper left corner. I open one and unfold the stiff stationery. The body of the letter is only two short paragraphs, with Bill Peach's signature on the bottom. It's congratulating us on the Burnside business. Tearing open the other, I find it too is from Peach. It too is short and to the point. It formally directs me to prepare for a performance review of the plant, which is to be held at headquarters. The smile I had from reading the first letter broadens. 3 months ago, that second letter would have dunked me into dread, because although it doesn't say so directly, I presume the review will be the occasion for determining the future of the plant. I was expecting some kind of formal evaluation, and now I'm no longer dreading it. On the contrary, I welcome it. What do we have to worry about? Hell, this is an opportunity to show what we've done. Throughput is going up as marketing spreads the word about us to other customers. Inventories are a fraction of what they were and still falling. With more business and more parts over which to spread the costs, operating expenses down, we're making money. The following week, I'm away from the plant for 2 days with my personnel manager, Scott Dolan. We're at an off-site, very confidential meeting in St. Louis with the division's labor relations group and the other plant managers. Most of the discussion is about winning wage concessions from the various unions. It's a frustrating session for me. At Barrington, we don't particularly need to lower wages, so I'm less than enthusiastic about much of the strategy suggested, knowing it could lead to problems with the union, which could lead to a strike, which could kill the progress we've been making with customers. Aside from all that, the meeting is poorly run and ends with very little decided. I return to Barrington. About 4 p.m, I walk through the doors of the office building. The receptionist flags me down as I pass. She tells me Bob Donovan has asked to see me the moment I arrive. I have Bob paged, and he comes hurrying into my office a few minutes later. What's up, Bob?
Hilton Smythe. He was here in the plant today.
He was here? Why?
Well, you remember the videotape about robots that was in the works a couple of months ago?
Yeah, that was killed.
Yeah, well, it was reincarnated. Only now it's Hilton, because he's productivity manager for the division, doing the speech instead of Granby. I was having a cup of coffee out of the machine over by Sea Isle this morning when I see this TV crew come trooping along. And by the time I found out what they were doing here, Hilton Smythe's standing at my elbow.
Didn't anybody here know they were coming?
Well, apparently Barbara Penn, our employee communicator, knew about it.
And she didn't think to tell anybody?
Well, see, the whole thing was rescheduled on short notice. Since you and Scott weren't around, she went ahead on her own, cleared it with the union, made all the arrangements. She apparently sent around a memo, but nobody got a copy until this morning.
Nothing like initiative. He goes on to tell me about how Hilton's crew proceeded to set up in front of one of the robots, not the welding types, but another kind of robot which stacks materials. It soon became obvious there was a problem, however. The robot didn't have anything to do. There was no inventory for it, and no work on its way. In a videotape about productivity, the robot, of course, could not simply sit there in the background and do nothing. It had to be producing. So for an hour, Donovan and a couple of assistants searched every corner of the plant for something the robot could manipulate. Meanwhile, Smythe became bored with the wait, so he started wandering around, and it wasn't long before he noticed a few things.
When we got back with the materials, Hilton started asking all kinds of questions about our batch sizes. I didn't know what to tell him, because I wasn't sure what you've set up at headquarters, and, I just thought you ought to know.
I feel my stomach twisting. Just then, the phone rings. I pick it up at my desk. It's Ethan Frost at headquarters. He tells me he's just had a talk with Hilton Smythe. I excuse myself to Bob, and he leaves. When he's gone and the door is shut, I talk to Frost for a couple of minutes and afterwards go down to see Lou. I walk through the door and start to tap dance. 2 days later, an audit team from headquarters arrives at the plant. The team is headed by the division's assistant controller, Neil Kravitz, a 50-ish man who has the wimpiest handshake and the most humorless stare of anyone I've ever met. They march in and take over the conference room. In hardly any time at all, they found we've changed the base for determining the cost of products.
This is highly irregular.
He's peering at us over the tops of his glasses, and he looks up from the spreadsheets. Lou stammers that, okay, maybe it wasn't exactly according to policy, but we had valid reasons for basing costs on a current 2-month period. It's actually a more truthful representation this way.
Sorry, Mr. Ruggo. We have to observe standard policy.
But the plant is different now. Around the table, all 5 accountants are frowning at Lou and me. I finally shake my head. There's no sense attempting to appeal to them. All they know are their accounting standards. The audit team recalculates the numbers, and it now looks as if our costs have gone up. When they leave, I try to head them off by calling Peach before they can return, but Peach is unexpectedly out of town. I try Frost, but he's gone too. One of the secretaries offers to put me through to Smythe, who seems to be the only manager in the offices, but I ungracefully decline. For a week, I wait for the blast from headquarters, but it never comes. Lou gets a rebuke from Frost in the form of a memo warning him to stick to approved policy, and a formal order to redo our quarterly report according to the old cost standards and to submit it before the review. From Peach, there is nothing. I'm in the middle of a meeting with Lou over our revised monthly report early one afternoon. I'm crestfallen. With the numbers based on the old cost factor, we're not going to make our 15%. We're only going to record a 12.8% increase on the bottom line, not the 17% Lou originally calculated. Lou, can't we massage this a little more?
From now on, Frost is going to be scrutinizing everything we submit. I can't do any better than what you see now.
Just then, I become aware of the sound outside the offices that's getting louder and louder. I look at Lou, and he looks at me. Is that a helicopter? Lou goes to the window and looks out.
Sure is, and it's landing an hour long.
I get to the window just as it touches down. Dust and brown grass clippings are whirling in the prop wash around the sleek red and white helicopter, with the blade still twirling down to a stop. The door opens, and 2 men get out.
That first one looks like Johnny Johns.
It is Johnny Johns.
Who's the other guy?
I'm not sure. I watch them cross the lawn and start to walk through the parking lot. Something about the girth and the strident, arrogant swagger of the huge, white-haired second man triggers the recollection of a distant meeting. It dawns on me who he is. Oh, God.
I didn't think he needed a helicopter to get around.
It's worse than God. It's Bucky Burnside. Before Lou can utter another word, I'm running for the door. I dash around the corner and into Stacy's office. She, along with her secretary and some people she's meeting with, are all at the window. Everybody is watching the damn helicopter. Stacy, quick, I need to talk to you right now.
Yeah?
What's the status on Burnside's Model 12s?
The last shipment went out 2 days ago.
It was on time?
Sure. It went out the door with no problems, just like the previous shipments.
I'm running again, mumbling thanks over my shoulder to her. Donovan! He's not in his office. I stop at his secretary's desk. Where's Bob?
I think he went to the men's room.
I go sprinting in that direction. Bursting through the door, I find Bob washing his hands.
On Burnside's order, were there any quality problems?
No, nothing I know about.
Were there any problems on that order?
He reaches for a paper towel and dries his hands.
No, the whole thing came off like clockwork.
Then what the hell is he doing here?
Is who doing here?
Burnside. He just landed in a helicopter with Johnny Johns.
What?
Come with me.
We go to the receptionist, but nobody's in the waiting area.
Did Mr. Johns come through here just now with a customer?
The two men in the helicopter? No, I watched them, and they went past here and into the plant.
Bob and I hustle side by side down the corridor and through the double doors into the orange light and production din of the plant. One of the supervisors sees us from across the aisle, and without being asked, points in the direction Johns and Burnside took. As we head down the aisle, I spot them ahead of us. Burnside is walking up to every employee he sees, and he's shaking hands with each of them. Honest, he's shaking hands, clapping them on the arm, saying things to them, and he's smiling. Johns is walking with him. He's doing the same thing. As soon as Burnside lets go of a hand, Johns shakes it as well. They're pumping everybody in sight. Finally, John sees us approaching, taps Burnside on the shoulder, and says something to him. Burnside dons this big grin and comes striding up to me with his hand extended.
Here's the man I especially wanted to congratulate. I was saving the best for last, but you beat me to it. How are you?
Fine, just fine, Mr. Burnside.
Rugo, I came down here because I want to shake the hand of every employee in your whole plant. That was a hell of a job this plant did on our order. A hell of a good job. Those other bastards had the order for 5 months. I still couldn't get it down. And here your people finished the whole thing in 5 weeks. Must have been an incredible effort.
Bucky and I were having lunch today, and I was telling him how you pulled out all the stops for him. How everybody down here gave it everything they had.
Yeah, we just did our best.
Yeah, mind if I go ahead?
No, not at all.
Won't hurt your efficiency, will it?
Not one bit. You go right ahead. I turn to Donovan then, and out of the corner of my mouth say, get Barbara Penn down here right away with the camera she uses for the employee news, and tell her to bring lots of film. Donovan goes trotting off to the offices, and Johns and I follow Bucky up and down the aisles, the three of us shaking hands with one and all. Johnny, I notice, is a-twitter with excitement. When Burnside is far enough ahead that he can't hear us, he turns to me.
What's your shoe size?
10.5. Why?
I owe you a pair of shoes.
That's okay, Johnny. Don't worry about it.
Al, I'm telling you, we're meeting with Burnside's people next week on a long-term contract for Model 12s. 10,000 units a year.
The number just about sends me reeling backwards.
And I'm calling in my whole department when we get back. We're going to do a new campaign pushing everything you make down here because this is the only plant we've got in this damn division that can ship a quality product on time. With your lead times, Al, we're going to blow everybody out of the market. Thanks to you, we finally got a winner.
Thanks, Johnny, but as it turned out, Burnside's order didn't take any extra effort at all.
Shh, don't let Burnside know.
Behind me, I hear two hourly guys talking.
What was that all about?
Beats me. Guess we must have done something right.
On the eve of the plant performance review, with presentation rehearsed and 10 copies of our report in hand, and with nothing more to do except imagine what could go wrong, I call Julie. Hi.
Hi.
Listen, I have to be at headquarters for a meeting tomorrow morning, and because Forest Grove is more or less on the way, I'd like to come up and be with you tonight. What do you think?
Sure, it sounds great.
So, I leave work a little early and hit the highway. As I head up the interstate, Barrington is spread out to my left. The Buy Me sign on top of the high-rise office building is still in place. Living and breathing within the range of my sight are 30,000 people who have no idea that one small but important part of the town's economic future will be decided tomorrow. Most of them haven't the slightest interest in the plant or what we've done here, except if Uniware closes us, they'll be mad and scared. And if we stay open, nobody will care. Nobody will even know what we went through. Well, win or lose, I know I did my best. When I get to Julie's parents' house, Sharon and Dave run up to the car. After getting out of my suit and into some off-duty clothes, I spend about an hour throwing a frisbee to the two kids. When they've exhausted me, Julie has the idea the two of us should go out to dinner. I get the feeling she wants to talk to me. I clean up a little and off we go. As we're driving along, we pass the park.
Al, why don't we stop for a while?
How come?
The last time we were here, we never finished our walk.
So I pull over, we get out and walk. By and by, we come to the bench by the river, and the two of us sit down.
What's your meeting about tomorrow?
It's a plant performance review. The division will decide the future of the plant.
Oh, what do you think they'll say?
Well, we didn't quite make what I promised Bill Peach. One set of numbers doesn't look as good as it truly is because of the cost of product standards. You remember me telling you about some of that, don't you? She nods. I shake my head momentarily, still angry at what happened as a result of the audit. But even with that, we still had a good month.
It just doesn't show up as the fantastic month we really had.
You don't think they'd still close the plant, do you?
I don't think so. A person would have to be an idiot to condemn us just because of an increase in cost of products. Even with screwed-up measurements, we're making money. She reaches over to take my hand.
It was nice of you to take me out to breakfast that morning.
After listening to me ramble on at 5 o'clock in the morning, you deserved it.
When you talked to me then, it made me realize how little I know about what you do. I wish you had told me more over the years.
I don't know why I haven't. I guess I thought you wouldn't want to hear it, or I didn't want to burden you with it.
Well, I should have asked you more questions.
I'm sure I didn't give you many opportunities by working those long hours.
When you weren't coming home those days before I left, I really took it personally. I couldn't believe it didn't have something to do with me. Deep down, I thought you must be using it as an excuse to stay away from me.
No, absolutely not, Julie. When all those crises were occurring, I just kept thinking you must know how important they were. I'm sorry. I should have told you more. She squeezes my hand.
I've been thinking about some of the things you said about our marriage when we were sitting here last time. I have to say you're right. For a long time, we have just been coasting along. In fact, we were drifting apart. I've watched you get more and more wrapped up in your job as the years have gone by. And to compensate for losing you, I got wrapped up in things like decorating the house and spending my time with friends. We lost sight of what was important.
I look at her in the sunlight, the awful frosting in her hair, which she had when I came home the day the NCX-10 went down, is finally gone. It's grown out. Her hair is thick and straight again, and all the same dark brown.
Al, the one thing I definitely know now is that I want more of you, not less. That's always been the problem for me.
She turns to me with her blue eyes, and I get a long-lost feeling about her.
I finally figured out why I haven't wanted to go back to Barrington with you. And it isn't just the town, although I don't like it very much there. It's that since we've been living apart, we've actually spent more time being together. I mean, when we were living in the same house, I felt as though you took me for granted. Now you bring me flowers. You go out of your way to be with me. You take time to do things with me and the kids. Al, it's been nice. I know it can't go on this way forever. I think my parents are getting a little tired of the arrangement. But I haven't wanted it to end.
I start to feel very good. At least we're sure we don't want to say goodbye.
Al, I don't know exactly what our goal is or ought to be, but I think we know there must be some kind of need between us. I know I want Sharon and Dave to grow up to be good people, and I want us to give each other what we need.
I put my arm around her. For starters, that sounds worth shooting for. Look, it's probably easier said than done, but I can certainly try to keep from taking you for granted. I'd like you to come home, but unfortunately, the pressures that caused all the problems are still going to be there. They're just not going to go away. I can't ignore my job.
I've never asked you to. Just don't ignore me or the kids, and I'll really try to understand your work.
You remember a long time ago, after we got married and we both had jobs, how we'd come home and just talk to each other for a couple of hours, sympathize with each other about the trials and tribulations we'd suffered during the day?
Mm-hmm.
That was nice.
But then there were the babies, and later you started putting in extra hours at work.
Yeah, we got out of the habit. What do you say we make a point to do that again?
That sounds terrific. Look, Al, I know that leaving you must have seemed selfish on my part. I just went crazy for a little while. I'm sorry.
No, you don't have to be sorry. I should have been paying attention.
But I'll try to make it up to you. Since we're walking down memory lane, maybe you remember the first fight we had, how we promised afterwards we'd always try to look at a situation from the other's point of view, as well as our own. Well, I think for the past couple of years, we haven't been doing that very often. I'm willing to try it again if you are.
I am too. There was a long hug. So, you want to get married?
I'll try anything twice.
You know, don't you? It's not going to be perfect. You know, we're still going to have fights.
And I'll probably be selfish about you from time to time.
What the hell? Let's go to Vegas and find a justice of the peace.
Are you serious?
Well, I can't go tonight. I've got that meeting in the morning. How about tomorrow night?
You are serious.
All I've been doing since you left is putting my paycheck in the bank. After tomorrow, it'll definitely be time to blow some of it.
Okay, big spender. Let's do it.
Chapter 31.
The next morning, on the 15th floor of the Unico building, I walk into the conference room at a few minutes before 10 o'clock. Sitting at the far end of the long table is Hilton Smythe, and sitting next to him is Neil Kravitz. Flanking them are various staff people. Good morning. Hilton looks up at me without a smile.
If you close the door, we can begin.
Wait a minute. Bill Peach isn't here yet. We're going to wait for him, aren't we?
Bill's not coming. He's involved in some negotiations.
I would like this review to be postponed until he's available. Smythe's eyes get steely.
Bill specifically told me to conduct this and to pass along my recommendation to him. So if you want to make a case for your plat, I suggest you get started. Otherwise, we'll have to draw our own conclusions from your report. With that increase in cost of products Neil has told us about, it sounds to me as if you have a little explaining to do. I, for one, would particularly like to know why you are not observing proper procedures for determining economical batch quantities.
I pace in front of them a moment before answering. The fuse to my anger has started a slow burn. I try to put it out and think about what this means. I don't like the situation one bit. Peach damn well ought to be here, and I was expecting to be making my presentation to Frost, not his assistant. But from the sound of it, Hilton may have set himself up with Peach to be my judge, jury, and possibly executioner. I decide the safest bet is to talk. Fine, but before I go into my presentation of what has been happening at my plant, let me ask you a question. Is it the goal of the Uniware division to reduce costs?
Of course it is.
No. Actually, that is not the goal. The goal of Uniware is to make money. Agreed? Kravitz sits up in his chair.
Well, that's true.
Hilton gives me a tentative nod. I'm going to demonstrate to you that regardless of what our costs look like according to standard measurements, my plant has never been in a better position to make money. And so it begins. An hour and a half later, I'm midway through an explanation of the effects of the bottlenecks upon inventory and throughput when Hilton stops me.
Okay, you've taken a lot of time to tell us all this, and I personally can't see the significance. Maybe at your plant you did have a couple of bottlenecks and you discovered what they were. Well, I mean, bravo and all that, but when I was a plant manager, we dealt with bottlenecks wandering everywhere.
Hilton, we're dealing with fundamental assumptions that are wrong.
I can't see that you're dealing with anything fundamental. It's at best simple common sense, and I'm being charitable at that.
No, it's more than just common sense, because we're doing things every day that are in direct contradiction to the established rules most people use in manufacturing.
Such as?
According to the cost accounting rules that everybody has used in the past, we're supposed to balance capacity with demand first, then try to maintain the flow. But instead, we shouldn't be trying to balance capacity at all. We need excess capacity. The rule we should be following is to balance the flow with demand, not the capacity. Two, the incentives we usually offer are based on the assumption that the level of utilization of any worker is determined by his own potential. That's totally false because of dependency. For any resource that is not a bottleneck, the level of activity from which the system is able to profit is not determined by its individual potential, but by some other constraint within the system.
What's the difference? When somebody is working, we're getting use out of him.
No, and that's a third assumption that's wrong. We've assumed that utilization and activation are the same. Activating a resource and utilizing a resource are not synonymous. And the argument goes on. I say an hour lost at a bottleneck is an hour out of the entire system. Hilton says an hour lost at a bottleneck is just an hour lost of that resource. I say an hour saved at a non-bottleneck is worthless. Hilton says an hour saved at a non-bottleneck is an hour saved at that resource.
All this talk about bottlenecks. Bottlenecks temporarily limit throughput. Maybe your plant is proof of that. But they have little impact upon inventory.
It's completely the opposite, Hilton. Bottlenecks govern both throughput and inventory. And I'll tell you what my plant really has shown. It's proved our performance measurements are wrong. Kravitz drops the pen he's holding, and it rolls noisily on the table.
Then how are we to evaluate the performance of our operations?
By the bottom line. And based upon that evaluation, my plant has now become the best in the Uniware division, and possibly the best in its industry. We're making money when none of the others are.
Temporarily, you may be making money. But if you're really running your plant this way, I can't possibly see how your plant can be profitable for very long.
Oh, Hilton, obviously...
The fact of the matter is that your cost of products measurement increased. And when costs go up, profits have to go down. It's that simple. And that's the basis of what I'll be putting into my report to Bill Peach.
Afterwards, I find myself alone in the room. Mr. Smythe and Kravitz have gone. I'm staring into my open briefcase. Then, with a fist, I slam it shut. I'm muttering to myself something about their pig-headedness as I exit the conference room and go to the elevators. I press the down button, but when the elevator arrives, I'm not there. I'm walking back up the corridor again, and I'm heading for the corner office. Bill's secretary, Meg, watches me approach. I stride up to her desk where she's sorting paper clips.
I need to see Bill.
Go right in. He's waiting for you.
Hello, Al. I knew you wouldn't leave without seeing me.
Take a seat. Hilton Smythe is going to submit a negative report about my plant, and I feel that as my manager, you should hear me out before you come to any conclusions.
Go ahead. Tell me all about it. Sit down. We're not in a rush.
I continue to talk. Bill puts his elbows on the desktop and his fingers together in front of his face. Finally, I stop.
And you explained all of this to Hilton.
In great detail.
And what was his response?
He basically refused to listen. He continues to claim that as long as cost of products increase, profits eventually have to go down.
Don't you think he has a point?
No, I don't. As long as I keep my operating expenses under control and Johnny Johns is happy, I don't see how profits can help but continue to go up.
Fine. Can you call Hilton, Nathan, and Johnny Johns in here, please?
What's going on?
Don't worry. Just wait and see.
It's not long before they all enter the room and take seats.
Hilton, you've heard Alex's report this morning. You've also seen all the financial results. As the productivity manager of the division and as a fellow plant manager, what's your recommendation?
I think that Alex should be called to order. And I think that immediate action should be taken in his plant before it's too late. The productivity in Alex's plant is deteriorating. Cost of products is going up, and proper procedures are not being followed. I think that immediate actions are in order.
And what about the fact that in the last 2 months, that plant has turned profits rather than losses, while releasing a lot of cash for the division?
That is only a temporary phenomenon. We must expect big losses in the very near future.
Johnny, do you have anything to add?
Yes, certainly. Alex's plant is the only one that can produce miracles, to deliver what the client needs in a surprisingly short time. You've all heard about Burnside's visit. With such a plant backing up sales, they can really go out and blast the market.
Yes, but at what price? Cutting batches to far below optimum size, devoting the entire plant to one order? Do you know the long-term ramifications?
But I haven't devoted the plant to one order. As a matter of fact, I haven't got any past due orders. All my clients are pleased.
Miracles exist only in fairy tales.
So, what's the verdict? Is my plant going to be closed?
No, not at all. Do you think we're such bad managers that we would close a gold mine?
I sigh in relief. Only now do I notice I've been holding my breath.
As manager of productivity of the division, I feel it's my duty to protest.
Bill ignores him and turns to Nathan and Johnny.
Shall we tell them now or wait until Monday? Hilton, this morning I asked you to sit in for me because Nathan, Johnny, and I were at a meeting with Granby. 2 months from now, the three of us are moving up the ladder to head the group. Granby left it to us to decide who will be the next manager of the division, and I think that the three of us have decided. Congratulations, Alex. You will be the one to replace me.
When I return to the plant, Fran hands me a message.
It's from Bill Peach. What's going on?
Call everybody. I have some good news. Bill's message is, I recommend you use these 2 months to prepare yourself. You still have a lot to learn, hotshot. At last, I'm able to reach Jonah in New York and fill him in on the latest developments. Although pleased for me, he does not seem surprised. And all this time, I was just worried about saving my one plant. Now it seems that I'm ending up with three.
Keep up the good work.
Jonah, wait. I'm afraid that luck will not be enough. I'm out of my depth. Can't you come down and help me? I haven't spent 2 hours tracking down Jonah just to hear his congratulations. Frankly, I'm terrified at the prospect of my new job. It's one thing to handle a production plant,
But handling a division of three plants does not mean just three times the work. It also means responsibility for product design and marketing.
Even if I had the time, I don't think it's a good idea.
Why not? It seemed to work fine so far.
Alex, as you climb up the ladder and your responsibilities grow, you should learn to rely more and more on yourself. Asking me to come now will lead to the opposite. It will increase the dependency.
I refuse to see his point. Can't you continue to teach me?
Yes, I can. But first, you should find out exactly what it is that you want to learn. Call me then.
I want to learn how to run an efficient division. Isn't it obvious?
Well, in the past, you wanted to learn how to run an efficient plant. Now you want to learn how to run an efficient division. We both know that it will not end here. What is it that you want to learn? Can you spell it out?
Actually, I guess that I want to learn how to manage a plant, a division, a company, any type or size organization. And it wouldn't be bad to learn how to manage my life, but I'm afraid that that would be asking for too much.
Why too much? I think that every sensible person should want to learn how to manage his or her life.
Great. When can we start?
Now. Your first assignment is to find out what techniques are needed for effective management.
What?
Come on, I didn't ask you to develop them, just to determine clearly what they should be. Call me when you have the answer. And Alex, congratulations on your promotion.